When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
Hi, welcome back to the Crossover NBA Podcast. On this episode, we're getting to the Celtics. Are they contenders once again? The Eastern Conference semifinals. Which team has the most at stake? And why is it that the Brooklyn Nets are not a preferred destination to that of the New York Knicks? That and much more. As always, best way to support this podcast, head over to Apple Podcasts where you can post a rating or leave a comment, maybe even do both. It's easy, it's free, and it's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. Also, if you like boxing, subscribe to the SI Boxing Podcast hosted by yours truly. That podcast comes out every single week. Also, every single week, my new SI TV show, In the Paint, premiere last week on SITV. My first guest was Commissioner Adam Silver. The show will appear on the SITV platform on Tuesdays and is only available on SITV. To subscribe, head over to si.tv. All right, joining me now in studio, a frequent guest, Rohan Nadkarni, staff writer at Sports Illustrated, and a newcomer to the podcast studio, the Associated Press NBA writer, Brian Mahoney. Welcome, Brian Mahoney.
Thank you, Chris.
Learn something new about Brian Mahoney.
This entire podcast is just an ad for Chris Mannix, by the way. Good God, how many plugs do you have, man?
Did I mention DAZN on
there?
Please
don't.
Plug them.
Oh, God.
A little bit.
All right.
I'm headed out to Fox Studios this week. I'm doing a little Cowherd and Speak for Yourself.
Of course. I mean, of course. Because what we need is more hot takes from you.
We do.
That you can then post on your Instagram is Chris Mannix quotes.
100%. 100%. That's what we need. I don't know why you're coming at me. I was about to come at Mahoney.
Okay, please do. Let's gang up on him now.
I mean, he tells me he doesn't watch Game of Thrones. And his excuse was, what was it? I haven't watched it, so I can't watch it. Is that basically what it boils down to?
It's too late now to start, I think.
It's never too late. It's never too late.
It's not too late. You get it. You start season one, episode one. Look, if I could like wipe it from my brain and rewatch it, I'd probably give up 6 months of my life. I'd probably just say, all right, I'll die 6 months earlier if I can rewatch Game of Thrones.
I'm with Chris
with
on
no
this
memory
one.
Of it.
I'm with Chris on this one. You're missing out on a cultural moment. It's not just a television show. It's one of the last things we have within a certain bubble that people are still kind of convening around.
Yeah, and you can like, I mean, I'm not married, but if I was, I'd place Emilia Clarke on my list of people I could.
Ugh,
you know
what?
What?
What is?
Emilia Clarke.
You don't need to go there.
What?
This is a basketball podcast. Come on,
I'm just
Chris.
Saying she's like the it woman of this generation.
I see. All right.
She's like what's her name from Star Wars was back in the 80s.
What's her
I'm blanking. Oh, the
Carrie Fisher.
Carrie Fisher.
R.I.P.
There we go.
Carrie Fisher, yes.
All right, but that's what I'm
saying.
Like,
I've seen Star Wars.
She's the Carrie Fisher of this generation. No? Am I wrong?
I don't know if I'd go that far. Also, whose generation? Not yours.
How old do you think Emilia Clarke is?
Younger than Chris Mannix.
Younger, but in her 30s, as am I. So
you were in your 30s?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
What did you think I was?
I don't know, dude. Maybe it's all the long flights or something catching up.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, you're not getting any of this podcast read material.
I see.
Let me tell you that much.
Okay.
This money's staying in my pocket. All right. Let's jump right into it, fellas. A lot to get into this week. NBA playoffs are in full swing. The one series that we know officially over at this point, the Celtics, they knock off the Indiana Pacers. It was expected. Indiana, I don't even know if they're a playoff team without Victor Oladipo. Good defensive team, but certainly not enough offense to compete in the postseason. The Celtics take care of business in four games. Is the takeaway that the Celtics are a legit contender in the conference once again, or is it just they beat up on a depleted Indiana team, Brian, and they still have a lot to prove?
Well, I think they still have some to prove, but I do think they're a legit contender. I think they would have beaten a lot of other teams the way they've played late in the season. Certainly watching Gordon Hayward, the way he's playing, you start to see now where, okay, they have what we thought they could be. Is it good enough to beat one of the top teams four times yet? I'm not sure. There's been so many times I've wanted to come back on Boston, and then they disappoint me again, so I'm not going to suddenly say, okay, yeah, this is definitely them, but at the same time, I now see where it can be them, the team that we all thought going into this was where we're supposed to be.
Yeah, I mean, this to me was a continuation, Rohan, of what we've seen the last 2 months of the regular season. Like this, you know, Gordon Hayward didn't play great, but he had a terrific game four. Kyrie Irving didn't have a banner series, but he closed when they needed him, and that's exactly what his role is going to be with this team. Al Horford was up and down, but they just flexed their depth. They had seven guys scoring double figures in that game four. Jaylen Brown has filled in nicely for Marcus Smart, both offensively and defensively. Bojan Bogdanovic never shot higher than 43% in that series in any game. And Jason Tatum looks like playoff Jason Tatum once again. Shot averaged about 20 points in this series, shot almost 50% from the floor, and shot about 54% from three. So, I don't know if this means they're the top team in the East or anything like that, but I think they're neck and neck. I don't think there's a big gap between anybody in the East, but I think Boston's right in that mix right now.
It's interesting. On one hand, they showed progress. The fact that they showed consistency for the first time all year, I think, is promising. At the same time, what are the Pacers? And this is not to be mean to Indiana. It's going to come off as mean. They're a little bit like a glorified 10 seed. You know what I mean? They were really bad against teams with a record above 500 after Oladipo's injury. Boston still had some struggles on offense in this series. I mean, those fourth quarters, every fourth quarter was close, right? It's kind of funny. You mentioned Bojan Bogdanovic. I mean, the Celtics are like trapping him hard late in the fourth, and like this is the guy they have to shut down. You know, so there's still some issues there. They weren't, great on offense. Indy obviously has a really good defense, but that's maybe a little concerning. My two takeaways for the Celtics are this, and they're both positive. One, I think it helped that Brad Stevens tightened the rotation, really just playing eight guys. I think that was a smart move on his part. It's going to be interesting to see what they do when Smart is healthy. I think they should stick to an eight-man rotation, even if that means Rozier, you know, loses some minutes. Beyond that, the most important thing, we talked about this before the playoffs started. Are they going to go back to that opening night starting five? And I think you were a little cool on it. They've played that lineup to a lot of success. That, to me, is the most important thing that happened for Boston, getting that group confidence, showing that it can succeed together, because I think that is the lineup they're going to need against these top teams.
I think it's a good lineup, Brian. I just think you need to play Aaron Baines at least 25 minutes a night, because his physical presence is just so badly needed. And we know that even though Al Horford was a good soldier all year long playing the five spot, he doesn't like playing the five spot. He's not really physical enough against most teams to play the five spot. He's much better when you have a big man like Aaron Baines alongside him. And now you can deploy that smallish start the season lineup.
Great closing group.
Sure, strategically. Kind of like the death lineup was a couple. Now Golden State went away from that last couple of years, but when they deployed it, it was extremely effective offensively. But I still think you need Baines to play a little bit more. But when you see Hayward play that well, Tatum play that well, even Brown play that well, it's a good sign for this team as they move forward.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's funny. At the end of the year, I asked an East coach, you know, who's going to win the East? And right away said Milwaukee. And at the last second said, but if Boston figures it out again, then Boston. And now you say, okay, has Boston figured it out? And yes, we do have to say, okay, the team they beat is not really an A-level team, not anywhere close to it, what Indiana is right now, and every game was kind of a struggle. But the bottom line is, Boston figured it out in every game. You know, whatever it took to win the game, they did eventually. They're going to have some rest now, which is important. You know, again, yes, Tatum looks fantastic like the Tatum was last year. Brown, who had his up and down moments this year, seems to be back. You know, everyone kind of seems to be going in the right direction, and it's the right time for that. So, yeah, I mean, there's no reason to look at Boston and say they can't do it anymore when a month and a half ago you might have thought that way.
I tell you, Rowan, Rozier is still a problem, though. I mean, he just can't get untracked in the way he did last year. And I thought, like you said, with the Smart injury, more opportunity, I thought that might do something for him. The playoffs coming around where he thrived in last year, that might do something for him. I think, you know, the Celtics probably hoping that Milwaukee, the team that Rozier really elevated his game against last year, where he became like, you know, this kind of cult figure in Boston with Drew Bledsoe showing up at his game and naming a wine after him, and the Eric Bledsoe kind of back and forth, maybe that inspires him. But he continues to be kind of a shell of his former self.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And that kind of, again, speaks to Boston at times offensively struggling with this team, relying a lot on Tatum and Kyrie to kind of do things down the stretch. That is an interesting, you make that point, because Bledsoe, on the other hand, is kind of reversed from what he did last year in the first round. He looked really good for Milwaukee. I'm really curious how that matchup's going to play out. I mean, it's inevitable, obviously, Milwaukee, we just assume, is going to steamroll the Pistons. That's going to be a really, really fascinating second round matchup.
Do you look, Brian, at, you know, you covered the Nets for a lot of years and saw a lot of Brook Lopez. Is Brook Lopez a problem in a playoff series? Now, he had a great regular season, and him developing a three-point shot, I mean, it's huge for his career. It extends it, basically, because he becomes sort of a modern big in a way. But I still look at Brook Lopez, and even though he was an anchor for that team defensively in the regular season, if you give a really good team and a versatile team and a smart coaching staff enough time to really dig into that, he still is kind of this sort of plodding big man that I think you can take advantage of with the right schemes. That to me is the big wild card in this series. Giannis averaged like 31 points per game against Boston. He's going to kick their ass. I don't care how well Semi Ojeleye plays out there. You know, they'll get theirs from Kyrie, and I'm sure Tatum will keep playing well, and Hayward keeps improving. But the effectiveness of Brook Lopez, to me, is one of the bigger wild cards of that whole series.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I'm sure you look to exploit, but, you know, a lot of teams do that. And, you know, to me, at the NBA nowadays, if you're a shooter, you're on the floor. And Brook Lopez is proven to be a shooter. And, you know, a lot of guys who, yeah, you want to attack them and say, okay, this is the matchup we're going to exploit. I get all that. But I also think Milwaukee has a lot of things they can do to counter that kind of thing. So, you know, can they make him a weakness? Sure, it's possible. But I certainly wouldn't say that's definitely going to work, because it's something everybody wants to start with. And Milwaukee has time and time again proven a way to make it happen.
Yeah, just piggybacking off of Brian there, something that's fascinating to me about these playoffs in general, who plays small anymore? I mean, you just mentioned the Celtics look really good with Aaron Baines out there. You know, as recently as last year, 2 years ago, all that mattered was, can you put a center on the floor who basically can switch at the end of the shot clock, right? Every team needed that guy. They needed a really nimble, athletic body at the five, even if he was just a rim-running type. Now you're seeing Embiid is out there. Jokic, who is, I mean, it's a different conference, obviously, but a guy we all thought is, what's he going to look like in a playoff series? Can he play in the last 4 minutes of every game? He's stepped up defensively. A weird league-wide trend is teams are kind of playing big again. You know, big men have kind of made the adjustment they've needed to make. And I'm with Brian the same way. Every, you know, I'm wondering, is Brook Lopez going to be the issue? I mean, it helped that Detroit played big, but I don't know any team that plays small anymore. And Milwaukee, if they really want to, can still out small teams by playing Mirotic and Giannis together in the front court. So I don't think there's an obvious advantage there for Boston if they go big or small.
Yeah, Giannis is the wild card defensively, because he probably will wind up playing a lot of minutes at the five, especially if Horford shifts over and maybe it becomes, they don't play any bigs out there. But, you know that because Lopez has been such a big part of what that team has done all season long, he's going to get some of those early minutes. I just looked up some of his numbers. He shot 6.3 threes per game this year.
Crazy.
Five per game in the first round. And he's not, just gunslinging.
And he's not just planted in the corner. I mean, he's like Eric Gordon for this team, you know?
It's wild how he's kind of transform. Let me kind of pivot to the other Eastern Conference matchups. And as we record this early in the week, we know what they are, basically. The top four seeds are going to advance in the first round. There's a lot at stake for every one of these teams, like franchise-changing stakes, where the winner of these games might see their franchise move forward in an extremely positive way, and the losers might see their teams dismantled. I mean, Boston, we know what they have to deal with this summer with Kyrie Irving. Can they stay? Philadelphia, how much money it's going to cost to invest in that team? Brett Brown, does he have to win a second-round series to keep this thing going in Philadelphia? Toronto, we know Kawhi Leonard and you know what goes on with him out there. So there are just – and Milwaukee, of course, they've got a whole bunch of free agents as well. They have to decide if this is the direction that they want to go because they're going to become a pricey team out there. Which team, Brian, do you think has the most to lose of those four that are competing? Who are the stakes the highest for amongst those four teams?
The hard part of that question for me is because the individual players are such wild cards a little bit that I don't know if you say the team winner loses the series, that's going to matter much in their decisions. You know, if anyone could tell me what Kawhi's going to do, I would be shocked. You know, Kyrie Irving, the same thing. These guys, it's hard to tell what's going to make them happy. So whether Boston or Toronto loses next round, the round after, or doesn't lose at all, I don't know how much that matters their decisions. You know, Philadelphia is probably the one I guess I would pick, you know, with obviously having Harris and Butler, and as you say, Brett Brown, a decision possibly to make there. There's more things at stake there who maybe can be influenced by winning or losing only. And Milwaukee, to me, is the one who I think says either way is a good year. You know, there's so much positive out of this season. They have their star. They have their coach. And if they lose to the team that's supposed to have won the East in most people's minds, I think you accept that and you maybe tinker a little bit. But, you know, everyone else, I just don't know which way they're going to go. And I don't think winning or losing necessarily impacts it either way.
You don't think that, just to follow up with you there, like you don't think that if Milwaukee loses and let's say Chris Middleton struggles, think that affects their decision making on Chris Middleton this summer? Because he's going to be a free agent and Milwaukee might be in a position because their cap space is so limited, they might have to max him out. Like, and then you all of a sudden, your books are tied in with two players, you know, three when you include Bledsoe and that new deal that he got. I mean, is that an impactful thing?
I mean, yeah. I mean, I guess if he struggles really, really bad, he gives you question marks. But the guy was an all-star this year. He's been a terrific, you know, improving every year kind of guy for them. You know, I would not want to say, okay, if he struggles against Boston with all the talent they have, that you need to say, wait a minute, we can't pay Chris Middleton. Now, they may not anyway, don't get me wrong, but I don't think we're going to see anything happen over the course of the next few weeks where you say, wait a minute, Milwaukee's got to start over to some extent or make some kind of really big move. I just think what they've done this year is find a style of play that works in the current NBA with a certain couple pieces already in place, and you just keep working with what you have there now.
Max Middleton. That's going to be his name.
Well, I kind of agree with Brian's line of logic here. I think Kyrie and Kawhi are going to make their decisions kind of independent on everything that happens. You know, Toronto's in this weird...
Yeah, Dwayne Wade the mind there too,
yeah.
Right?
Like Kyrie, yeah, Dwayne, of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, relax.
Always comes back to Dwayne
Wade. Says the person who's brought up the Celtics at the top of every
podcast. I let your early shots go by.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. I think, you know, Kawhi especially, what's funny is, you know, I don't know how winning can influence his decision when he influences Toronto's winning the most. I will say this about Philadelphia. Tobias Harris, three incredible straight games against the Nets, right? Really coming along, been, you know, averaging 24 points the last three games. What if Tobias Harris plays himself into a max contract? Like, for Philly, there's so much on the line here where they need Butler and Tobias to be good, but what if they're too good? What if they end up with four max guys and they're locked into this core? The crazy thing about the East to me, and it applies to Milwaukee as well, Brian brought it up, you do too, Chris, is the success could almost work against these front offices. Like, this is a much smaller scale example, but think about the Orlando Magic. Vucevic has this incredible season, all-star. The best thing that's happening for Orlando's future might be Vucevic's struggles, because now they don't have as much of a reason to offer him a max contract, right? We value, I think, too much flexibility sometimes in front offices. It's the way the NBA is covered now. Assets are almost like fetishized to an absurd degree. But having said that, when you're a team like Philly and Milwaukee and you're so close, you have transcendent talents, you have to nail these moves. Otherwise, you're locking yourself into just short of a finals, you know, team. I do think because of this summer, the landscape's shaping up to change so much, especially if Durant leaves. What it takes to be a title team is going to change a lot. So if you're Milwaukee and you have a transcendent talent like Giannis, you can put Middleton and Bledsoe around him, even though they aren't traditional second and third bananas. But Philly, I mean, they're stuck in such a weird spot because the better they play, the more reason they'll have to throw big money at all these guys. And their line is particularly fragile because of Embiid's health, because of Butler's injury history. We don't know what Harris is going to be like, you know, long term with this team. So Milwaukee and Philly are kind of the teams I have my eye on, because success may almost lock them into teams that they're not 100% comfortable with.
Yeah, I think it's Philly that tops my list too, because I think Tobias Harris is going to get close to a max contract no matter what.
Yeah.
I think there are teams out there that after the first wave of top-tier
exactly.
guys sign, like, they'll go a little crazy. I mean, would the Nets make a big offer for Tobias Harris? Isn't that kind of the type of player that they really need in Brooklyn?
If they're watching the last two games, why wouldn't they do it today?
Look, the Knicks, we know they're willing to throw money around if they wind up striking out for some reason on a Kyrie Irving or somebody else. I think the Sixers are almost in an impossible situation, because you can't just let Tobias Harris walk because you gave up two first-round picks to go and get him. It's the same thing with Jimmy Butler. I mean, I thought the Butler deal was a little nutty because I like Saric and I like Covington as role players. You need role players to have a successful team, and you can't just let Butler walk. But what if that means you have to pay him like a five-year contract? Like, that's a lot of years to pay a guy that I think at some point you're going to see his body break down over the next, you know, maybe not next year, the year after, but year three maybe in that contract. He's battled injuries before. I think that could be problematic.
There are many interesting things about Philly, the threads that their kind of franchise hangs on. One, I think if they knew the Tobias Harris trade was happening, they wouldn't have made the Butler trade, because they'd have more depth. They'd have guys on manageable contracts.
Yeah.
What we're going to see Philly have to deal with this summer is two things that have sunk a lot of NBA teams in the past. One, you compound an earlier mistake. Let's say they max Tobias Harris because they say, we can't afford to let this guy walk after what we gave up for him. And he turns out to be not a max player. That's compounding a mistake. We've seen teams do that where they say, we gave up XYZ to get this guy, so now we have to do this to kind of prevent ourselves from it. Instead of, you know, we had this conversation with the Wizards, just cutting bait and realizing you make the mistake. And another one is, every summer, an NBA team makes a mistake based off what happened in the playoffs. Mm. It's like the Bismack Biyombo special. You see a guy have a great series. Maybe he does it against you, and he just gets some insane contract in the summer. I'm worried because so many teams are going to have cap space this summer. There are only so few stars to go around. Someone might do something drastic.
Yeah. My second choice would be Toronto, because I do think that Kawhi will be influenced by winning. I think that I look at it as the Clippers are the leader in the clubhouse, but if you get to a finals, it's hard to leave a finals team. As strong as the Clippers are built structurally, you know, from the management position, you know, down to the coaching staff and the players they have on the roster, and Kawhi would be an ideal fit, I think, with that group, you may have to get to the finals to keep Kawhi Leonard in Toronto.
And I mean, I think they've, you know, first of all, look, the guy asked out of San Antonio, which is the best organization in sports. So, you know, what more can a team show? They're committed to winning. And, you know, Toronto, look, you know, they went out and, you know, got Marc Gasol. They made moves here. It's not like Kawhi can say, wait a minute, you guys didn't try hard enough to win. I think the commitment has been there. I don't think there's any reason now for him to question it, even if they fall short. If they lose to, again, whoever knocks them off now, if they get knocked off, is a really, really good team. It's not like they can say, we lost to we're too far away. Either way, they're pretty close. I think he has to make a determination off something other than whether he thinks they can win.
Kawhi's percolating, by the way. He's starting to show that playoff Kawhi's coming back. That's exciting. I'm excited. Fun to watch.
You know, aside from, I think, one game against the Magic, he's just been all over the place out there. He looks like the finals MVP once again. Let me stick in New York here for a second. The Knicks are looked at as the top free agent destination. I have no idea why. Like, I don't. Because, you know, it is New York, it is Madison Square Garden, but they haven't won shit since the early 1970s, and their owner is just like, I don't know where you rank him in the list of bad owners, but he continues to make mistakes, you know, public mistakes that haunt this franchise. And yet still, we're talking about Kevin Durant going to the New York Knicks. We're talking about Kyrie Irving going to the New York Knicks. Now, Irving, I kind of understand because he grew up in Northern Jersey and he was a Knicks fan growing up. I kind of get that. But at what point do the Nets surpass the Knicks in an appealing destination? Because outside of Madison Square Garden and the name New York in the Knicks across the jersey, they are better in every possible way. They have a more solid front office headed by Sean Marks. They have, no distraction, I think David Fizdale's a good coach, but Kenny Atkinson has proven himself a little more in this league with this Nets team. They're just structurally sounder than the Knicks, and you can still live in New York City. Like, you can live in New York and get all the benefits of playing for the Nets. I mean, is it, Brian, that if you win in New York, you become kind of a god because they haven't won since Dave DeBuscher was in uniform? Or is there something more to all this, the appeal of the New York Knicks?
I mean, it's all that stuff. And certainly, you know, you're making the case I think the Nets will make this summer in a lot of ways, saying, you know, okay, everything you said, look, we have Sean Marks, we have Ken Atkinson, we have this and that. The Knicks have the Garden, and that's really all they have. You know, destination-wise, look, a lot of guys didn't grow up wanting to play in Brooklyn. Brooklyn didn't exist. It wasn't a team. It's a team that's been there, whatever now, 6-7 years, and that's a lot to overcome. It's the Knicks. You know, I laugh. People say it's this great organization. It's not. It's a traditionally long organization. They haven't done a lot well for a long time, but they've been here, and they've been on TV, and they've been playing in this great arena that the players said, okay, I want to go play there. We love it. And, you know, how much have the Nets chipped away at that? I'm not sure, because the Nets haven't been good in Brooklyn for a couple years. You know, they made the second round once, and the last 3 years they were as bad as the Knicks were. So they've had one great year now where they have shown everything is coming together, and that's maybe not enough time to chip away at what the Knicks have. And, you know, should the Knicks have those advantages? I'm not sure, because we watch how bad they've been. But to the players, they say, whoa, I love New York City. I love the Garden. They haven't won there, but they didn't have me. And if they have me, they're going to win. And the owner will stay out of the way when I'm there, because I'm going to be really good for them. And that's what happens. Is it, you know, should it be that way? I'm not sure. But those are the reasons why I think the Knicks at least feel like they're still ahead of the Nets going into this thing.
I think if the Nets, Ron, had been able to win the series against Philadelphia, I think that would have been impactful. Because, I mean, you guys were both at that some of those games in Brooklyn. Like, the crowds were great at that game. You really had some energy, and you had, like, New York-style energy in that crowd. And that's something that's going to take time with the Nets, because, you know, Nets fans, like, really all the Nets have been up until this point have been, like, a poor man's version of the Florida Marlins in baseball, for lack of a better example. Like, just trying to buy a championship to go out there and spend a whole bunch of money, then deconstruct the team. Didn't happen, you know, back then. But they were more kind of goofy and awkward than a team that you'd look at as a real contender. They need those, like, 3- and 4-year-olds who are born in the Brooklyn area, who are given, like, Nets gear as kids, to grow up as real Nets fans that will eventually buy Nets tickets and Nets jerseys and really establish the kind of cultural fan base that the Knicks have. The Knicks have generations of fans that worship, and I think that resonates with some players, especially ones that live in the New York area. But I do wonder, Rowan, like, to Brian's point, like, how much did they chip away at the advantage that the Knicks have this summer? And will there be a player, be it Durant or Irving, or I don't know if I want to put Butler in that mix, but will there be a top-tier free agent that picks the Nets over the Knicks?
It's going to be tricky. First of all, they're definitely going to get in meetings, right? Maybe they need another Chris Mannix cover story to kind of juice them up
a little bit. That didn't go well.
Here's what I'll say. I mean, for a purely basketball standpoint, the Nets are better situated, right? I think there's no disagreeing with that. We've just heard Durant to the Knicks for so long, and I'm going to play devil's advocate for a little bit and say why maybe the Knicks make sense for someone like Durant. So Durant specifically, if you're looked at as a guy, I think obviously his career the last few years, it's looked at as, well, Chris noisily drinks something. I hope that was worth it, as I'm making my astute point.
I need some water.
I think for the Knicks, you offered Durant something that he can't get with the Nets, which is a complete reversal of his narrative. He's right now the guy who went to a franchise that didn't need any help and won 3 titles there with a player who may not be as good as him, but is probably more important to his team than Durant is. If you go to New York, you have an opportunity to reverse any narrative for any player. Like, I saved this franchise that has been pathetic for so long. Also, for New York, as much as we joke about, you know, they're terrible, whatever, they have a chance to land Zion Williamson with the number one pick. They can either draft Zion, maybe find a way to package him for Anthony Davis, and they have 2 max slots. Something that's underrated about the Nets, their cap sheet is slightly tricky because of D'Angelo Russell. Again, his success is now kind of a cudgel for the Nets, because do you max this guy out? Do you see if Kyrie wants to join? What do you do with his situation? So I agree, if I'm Kevin Durant, I would want to play for the Nets because I seamlessly plug into this small forward spot where they're playing, you know, Trevion Graham, and it makes a lot of sense.
Jared Dudley.
Exactly. But I also see why there are some appeals to the Knicks. I will say, just talking to guys, every time you talk to a star player, it's not even a question for them. Madison Square Garden, they all say, that's my favorite road arena to play in. There's something about, you know, if you grew up watching, again, they might not have been good, but you saw them on TV a lot. They were a big market. There's just something special about that place for basketball players. You know, it might not make sense to us, but, you know, who knows how much something we don't talk about, what shadow influence do the shoe companies also have on a decision like this? You know, do they want guys playing for the Knicks? Do they feel like, you know, if Nike's paying Kevin Durant $30 million a year, they realistically have some kind of influence on some of his career decisions. So there's a lot that goes into that, and I think that's why these decisions happen, because they're not made for pure basketball reasons.
I also think it matters this year, too. What do other players really think about Russell, if the Nets want to keep him? Because, you know, you got to have... unless you're getting two guys at once, like the Knicks maybe can do, you got to have one before you have two.
Right. You need some infrastructure.
And do players say, wait a minute, I want to go play with D'Angelo Russell? Is he at that level now where you say, okay, maybe he can attract someone to come play here? Because otherwise, look, as much as this infrastructure is very good, there's nothing else really you say, wait, I got to go play with that guy. These are all players who are getting better there, but he's the only all-star. And if they think he's going to be a perennial all-star who's going to be there for a while, maybe they say, okay, I'll go to Brooklyn. If not, Knicks are maybe a better choice because I can go with someone else there, and then we have two stars.
Well, this was my problem with them trading Porzingis, though, because Porzingis would have been that anchor. And I've said this in this podcast before, I never bought the narrative that, well, Porzingis didn't want to be here,
that
so
was
he
bullshit.
Had to trade
that was
him.
Bullshit.
Like, I don't know what Porzingis does this summer, but if he signed a full max contract with Dallas, I wouldn't surprise me at all.
He's going to.
Like, I mean, it just... It was kind of just like, don't try to sell me that. Like, you wanted to clear double max cap space because you believe in your heart of hearts, whether it's through intuition or tampering, that you are going to get Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving to come and play there. But if you had Porzingis there, unless, you know, you'd heard from Durant that he didn't want to play with Porzingis and hated him, which I can't really fathom that being the case, you would have that infrastructure. You would have a potential franchise player already there, a guy that can play multiple positions, has proven is a high-level talent in this league as the backbone. And now, as it stands, you're asking Kevin Durant to roll the dice and be the first one in, or you're asking the relationship between Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving to be so strong that they'll all of a sudden decide, we're coming together. And that is a really big risk for a team that hasn't done well with really big risks in the last couple of decades.
I will say, as much as we talk about these guys signing with the Knicks, something we haven't seen, in even in this era of players really taking control of their destinies, I mean, I guess LeBron was the first one, but we really haven't seen a guy, I guess I shouldn't say it because LeBron did it, but LeBron was the guy who first time really went to a team that wasn't that good, right? Usually in stars in these situations, when they're teaming up, whatever it is, they go to a team that has that existing infrastructure in place, or they go with another star. Maybe LeBron going to the Lakers has now opened it up for guys to kind of take more risks like this.
Yeah, but that was totally different. You know that.
Absolutely, like, for sure. I mean, but I will say, in defense of guys like Durant, Irving, and Leonard, they also all already have championships, right? So they don't feel as much need to chase that, and that changes the calculus more than what we're used to in the past. I also just want to say, I can't think of three parties that deserve each other more than Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, and the New York Knicks. I would love for that to happen just because of how absurd all three of those entities are. And I would love nothing more for them to get together and honestly kind of flame out. It would be fun.
I think people don't understand. Like, Kyrie is a risk because of the health issues in the past. Like, he's had three knee surgeries in the last few years. This is one of the reasons why I think Kyrie might be more likely to stay in Boston, because
they offer him five.
I've been writing this for months, and he's been now saying it over and over again. Like, man, last year, the two knee surgeries, I was in so much pain. I'm taking antibiotics. You know, that stuff is still in his head. Like, and when you, and I wondered, and I've said this before too, but, you know, the John Wall injury, does that sit with players? Like, John Wall took the bird in the hand. Smart move. John Wall is set probably for life because he took the money when it was offered, and now when he's coming off a catastrophic, potentially career-altering injury, he is sitting back and he is going to be set financially. Does Kyrie think the same things? And all things are not equal. Like, Boston's really good, whereas the Knicks, maybe, to your point, Rohan, if they get Zion Williamson, they can keep him or trade him, and they get Kevin Durant, in year one, they're probably not a championship team.
I mean, if
you got to build out the roster around those guys.
If they get Durant, Kyrie, and Zion, I think they're top four in the East.
You're asking a lot of Zion in year one. Oh, a top four team in the East?
Yeah, easy. Durant's the best player in the league.
Yes. Well, best scorer in the league. I don't know if he's the best player in the league. That's up for debate. Giannis is probably the best player in the league. The guy's going to win Defensive Player of the Year, too. So it's like,
I agree. But, I mean, Durant has that. I would take Durant over Giannis today.
Oh, no, you wouldn't. For what, 1 year?
No, just like right now, I need to win one game. I'm taking Durant over Giannis.
Maybe, yeah, because he's more versatile offensively.
And I think Kyrie is better than the second best guy on the Bucks. So I think that you'd get a pretty good team around them quickly.
Yeah. So they, if they, how bad is it, Brian, if they whiff in free agency? Like, what happens if they, like, it's Boogie and Jimmy Butler next year?
I think they have to score this time. I really do. And, you know, I get the old, we're not going to change course and we can save our money for next year. We can't make a bad decision now.
They say stuff and then they double back. Like, you know, you've been around them. And look, I agreed with the Steve Mills philosophy, the Scott Perry philosophy of, look, we're going to sign guys like Azonia to one-year contracts. Made a ton of sense. Don't tie up your books with bad contracts. But they just sort of, whichever ways the wind blows, they change their mind on this stuff.
Right. But I think this time, particularly now, where A, there's so many good free agents out there, and B, the one thing we've said about the Knicks is, oh my gosh, they've been a circus show. They've cleaned up the circus this year for the most part. If now they behave normally and they still don't get guys, then what are you going to say? Then you're going to say, wait, we might never get guys. So I think this time they have to get somebody. They've asked the fans to be patient to tank this year. You know, the fans went along with it, but now you have to deliver something, I think. And I assume they will. There, again, so many guys out there, and there's so much money they have to spend. But, again, if they don't, I don't think there's, oh, no, we can stick with the plan, and everyone will be fine with that.
I think they'll be better in the room this year than they have been in years past. I mean, your bestie Dwayne Wade said recently that, or did it, I sort of talked on the Woj pod years back about how when he met with the Knicks back in 2010, like, they didn't seem like they were prepared to be a championship-level team. Now, you've got David Fizdale extremely popular amongst players. Scott Perry has a championship from his days in Detroit. I know it was a long time ago, but he has that on his resume. The wild card's Dolan. Like, does Dolan get in the, is Dolan invited to these meetings? Like, I mean, can you
imagine Dolan will distance himself.
Based on what?
He seemed to have taken a step back when Phil Jackson was hired. And I think that, I'm not saying that this is a man known for his self-awareness, but I think that he has the ability to step back when the time is needed. And I think that at the end of the, I also, again, we've heard Durant to the Knicks for so long. I think a lot of these players are going to make decisions independent of someone like Dolan. At the end of the day, as bad as he is as an owner and the mistakes he's made, I think that the talent believes that their talent can win out. And I don't think that that's an insane theory on their part.
I just wonder if it gets to the meetings point. I mean, Kevin Durant's probably going to meet with the Clippers, and the Clippers are going to have Doc Rivers in the room. They're going to have Lawrence Frank and his staff. We're going to be uber prepared for it in the room.
Lee Jenkins, hopefully.
Lee Jenkins sitting in the room, pen in hand, ready to author an internal feature on Kevin Durant. I think if it gets to the sitting in the room, that's when, if I'm the Knicks, I sweat a little bit. I get a little bit anxious, Brian, about getting bested by a team that's better than me in the room.
Maybe Dolan will bring the Eagles or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like I said, there's nowhere to go but up from 2010 when they kind of, you know, went extremely poorly. I think this time they will be more prepared. They have guys who are personable. Phil Jackson was arrogant. They were mistake prone. You know, Dolan, I think, is at the point now where I really do believe he will let it be. If they say, we want you there, he'll come. If they don't, he won't. I don't think he'll insist on coming. And it, you know, I don't think players let it matter. I think players think, how's the locker room? How's the facilities? Where can I live? Blah, blah, blah. How much are you going to pay me? I think, how's the owner is like question 37.
I don't know, man. Maybe it's down the list, but I think it's relevant. I think when you, and maybe it's not in the room relevant, but I think San Antonio has benefited from having like a hands-off owner like Peter Holt over the years. I do think, speaking of owners in the room, I think Steve Ballmer should be in the room. I mean, his energy is contagious. Like, you bring Steve Ballmer in, he's like, yeah, championship coming to L.A. Microsoft's, you know, you let, like, free tablets for everybody in your family. Like,
I think players ultimately care most about the owner. Is this guy going to pay whatever it takes?
And I mean, that's kind of, the money's so, it's, well, the
it's
same.
It's more so like a luxury tax thing. Like, I think guys are like, you know, okay, Ballmer's got deep pockets, he's going to pay, Dolan will pay, you know, whatever. And I think guys probably care about that more than, you know, hanging out with Dolan or whatever. Yeah.
Well, we'll see. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with those meetings this summer. All right, let me finish in L.A., another big market team sort of in flux right now. You got the Lakers out there, and their season ended a couple of weeks back. Magic Johnson quits. And I wrote in the immediate aftermath that, you know, Magic Johnson gave them a gift. Magic Johnson walked away. He wasn't qualified for the job. At the same time, he wasn't awful at the job. He didn't leave the franchise in disrepair. They still had their draft picks. Their books were in good shape. LeBron was there. Young players still there. They didn't make any kind of catastrophic trades. Yes, they bungled this past season, but it was nothing long term. Everything there was fine. I assumed that ownership, specifically Jeannie Buss, would learn from that. Like that she would say, all right, well, you know, maybe hiring the ex-Laker wasn't the best idea. Maybe I should go against decades of tradition in that respect and look outside the organization. That, guys, does not seem to be happening. It seems like, as we record this on Monday, that Rob Pelinka is the guy. That whether he is elevated to Magic Johnson's position or if he is just there in his current position, he is going to be the guy that runs the day-to-day operations with the LA Lakers. He's interviewing coaches right now. He met with Ty Lue. He met with Monty Williams. It seems like the Lakers are content at this moment to let Rob Pelinka be the man in charge. Brian, what's your reaction to the direction the Lakers seem to be going?
I mean, it's a little surprising, obviously, given that it's the Lakers and you say they can probably get anybody. You know, I can't argue that he is not the guy. I don't know for sure. Like you say, they've done some things right, some things went wrong, but there's, like you say, there's been, you know, good young players there. There's cap space. There's LeBron. Like, you know, we can't say the front office has been a disaster. It has been A-plus level, but it's not an F. And maybe they think Pelinka can do it. At the same time, I would probably at least ask who else is interested. You know, again, knowing, you know, what the Lakers can probably pay, all the, you know, positives that, you know, who's going to not at least have a conversation with them, I would think, and maybe you can get whoever you think is the top of the list. They might at least say, okay, I'll talk to you about it. But, you know, yeah, the long story short, I'm surprised a little bit the way it's all gone over the last couple weeks there and the way it seems to be heading when there's at least an avenue to explore something else as well.
Look, I don't think that you should exclude Rob Pelinka from consideration there because the drafts have been done well, and if you're going to criticize him and Magic Johnson for what they did with free agency, got to give him credit for the draft. I mean, drafting the guys they did, Kyle Kuzma, Josh Hart, these are good players at the back end of the first round, and that's really tough. But you got to have, I think, an open search for all this. And you've got some of the top-tier executives who, with their respective franchises, might be in a position to say, you know what, maybe now is the time for me to walk away. I mean, Sam Presti in Oklahoma City is sitting there. His team looks like they're on the way out in the first round of these playoffs. Presti would not be leaving the team a mess because Russell Westbrook and Paul George are signed to long-term contracts. There's at least some stability there if he walked away. Same thing with Bob Myers. Maybe Bob Myers up at Golden State says, all right, Kevin Durant's probably going to leave. Maybe I have to trade Draymond Green. We're still championship level, but maybe now's the time where I can go back to my UCLA roots and go, you know, take over a job with the Lakers. And I've been kind of railing against for the R.C. Buford stuff. I don't know if anybody's even called him to ask him, you know, I know you're Spurs for life, but would you ever
give him a blank check?
Yeah, I mean, would you want $20 million and the keys to the, you know, most marketable franchise in the league? I don't know. I just think I'm surprised, Rohan, that there has not been a wide-ranging search. From day one, that when Magic left, it seemed like Rob Pelinka was empowered by Jeannie Buss, and this is kind of the way it's going to be.
Yeah, I think Brian was being really charitable. I agree the front office hasn't been a disaster, but they've made the wrong decision at every turn since LeBron James signed there. It's like the George Costanza bit where he starts doing the opposite of all of his instincts and his life becomes better. The Lakers need to George Costanza, they need to start doing the opposite of everything they've been doing for the last year. Rob Pelinka, I can't stress this enough. Why is this man qualified to be the general manager of an NBA team? His resume is Kobe Bryant's agent. It makes no sense that he's been given the keys here. But let's say
there's a history, though, of agents having success.
I understand. I
mean, Bob Myers is a great example. Neil O'Shea, another example of it.
But this is just so classic Lakers short-sightedness. The fact that they are running a coaching search before deciding what their front office structure is going to look like is absurd.
That tells me maybe they have decided.
And it's just completely backwards. It makes no sense that they haven't even seemingly given any thought to what they want the front office to look like. If it's being handed over to Pelinka, I think that's a big mistake. LeBron James went from 8 straight NBA finals to out of the playoffs entirely. Yes, I understand that he was injured, but they made so many bad decisions after signing LeBron James that contributed to that happening. It's just, it's absurd. It bothers me because I'm someone who wants to see LeBron James have a chance at success again in the NBA. I want to see him, you know, play in other finals. I want to see LeBron James in high stakes basketball games. And the Lakers are doing everything in their power to make that not possible. If I'm LeBron, I'm terrified at my basketball future in LA because this is a huge summer for them. And they're not, I agree, Magic gave them an opportunity to make a slam dunk front office hire. At the same time, they haven't taken that step forward. Magic, at least, was a guy, helped them land LeBron, could be in a room and command the respect of free agents. They don't have any of that now. I'm incredibly concerned with what's happening in LA.
I'm just surprised, too, that you know there's now talk that Magic could be part of the recruiting process this summer. I mean, how do you... I know he's still Magic Johnson, and that's great, and he seems to have jumped right back on Twitter and is all about you know tweeting at people and congratulating people and doing what he wants to do. And I've always said, more power to you, man. That's the life you want. You got $1 billion. You're one of the greats of all time. You're more recognizable anywhere.
Yeah, let Magic cook. Magic's having a good time, baby.
Do your thing. It's just, you know, I thought Jeannie Buss would learn from this, Brian. I thought that there'd be some kind of open search there. And look, it's a complicated job because if LeBron wasn't there, you could take a slow play with all this because they are in decent shape with their cap. They're in decent shape with their young players. You can grow that team organically. But with LeBron there, all of a sudden there's a big clock right on the wall.
Timeline-wise, they're a mess.
On how much? But how do you balance those two? You want to be careful not to go out and just blow money on a Jimmy Butler, or blow money on DeMarcus Cousins, and hope, cross your fingers, that you can get a star with all these young players. Because, I mean, whoever the coach is next year, it's going to be a challenge if you have to come to camp with the young players still there and LeBron still there after all they went through last season.
Well, that's obviously, I think, the number one reason why they would have trouble getting a candidate. When you say, all right, wait a minute. Okay, I'd go in there and I'd say, all right, their timeline is 2023. The Warriors will be done by then, and then you'll have, you know, Ingram and Hart and Kuzma and all these guys will all be ready to win maybe. Oh, but we got LeBron. We can't wait till then. So what do you do? And that's... how do you hire a coach then, knowing what's your mandate? Now
it also limits the number of coaches you can really look at. Like, you can't go out and get the next Kenny Atkinson because will that coach have the gravitas to coach a LeBron James? It's why Monty Williams, who's got a strong history throughout the league. Look, Monty Williams is a great coach and deserves an opportunity to coach somewhere else. But he, Ty Lue, that's it. Like, your list is really finite in coaches you can go out there and really interview seriously.
It's gonna be Ty Lue, Kemba Walker, Boogie Cousins, LeBron James on opening night. Like, where can I bet that? I'm so mentally prepared for it to be like a suicide squad of free agent rejects, Ty Lue and LeBron James. It's gonna be absurd.
Boogie Cousins, I could see. If they whiff on, and look, we've said this in this podcast before. Like, they're not at the top of everybody's list. Like, they're just not. It's not because the Lakers, you know, sizzle has worn off. It's just there are other more appealing places, whether it's the Knicks, or whether it's Clippers, other teams out there. Those second-tier guys, maybe DeMarcus takes their money, maybe Jimmy Butler takes their money. They can be a lot better, and you get LeBron in the playoffs. Who knows what could happen, but, man, I don't know. I'm just surprised they haven't really fleshed out this search because I think that is the most appealing job in the NBA. The job that Magic Johnson vacated is the best job in the NBA because you have infinite resources, a blank checkbook, and the backdrop of the Lakers to sell anybody. It's just, it's a little bit wild. All right, fellas, appreciate it. Brian, we'll see you a little bit later on. You'll be on my SI TV show, In the Paint, which you can stream on SI.TV, and check out Rohan's show. Is that still going on there?
Yeah, I'm still waiting for my invite for In the Paint, though. And yes, Crossover TV going strong. Over 50 episodes in.
50 episodes?
Yeah,
but you got to like cycle through co-hosts like NBA team cycle through coaches.
I don't know about that. Some people I could say I'd be hard to work with. You know, I have very high standards of success, Chris. So
I feel like LeBron said that last year. That's not how it works.
No, listen, man. It's a great, our show is fun. Have a good time. Yeah, but I'm still waiting for my In the Paint
invite. We will make that happen.
Okay, we'll make that happen.
All right, fellas, thanks for joining me. When we come back, my interview with NBA Commissioner Adam Silver. All right, I'll get back to my guests in a minute, but I have to tell everyone about our newest sponsor, the folks over at Blue Chew. Guys, remember the days when you were always ready to go? Now you can increase your performance and get that extra confidence in bed.
Listen up. BlueChew.com. That's blue like the color blue. BlueChew.com brings you the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis, so you know they work. You can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach. And since they're chewable, they work up to twice as fast as a pill, so you can be ready whenever an opportunity arises. Now, this isn't just for guys who can't perform. It's for any guy who wants any extra function to enhance their performance in the bedroom. Blue Chew is prescribed online and shipped straight to your door in a discreet package, so no in-person doctor's visits, no waiting in the pharmacy, and best of all, no more awkwardness. They're made in the USA, and since Blue Chew prepares and ships direct, they're cheaper than a pharmacy. Right now, we've got a special deal for our listeners. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first shipment free when you use our special promo code MANIX. Just pay the $5 in shipping fee. Again, that's BlueChew, BlueChew.com, promo code MANIX to try it free. Blue Chew is a better, cheaper, and faster choice, and we are happy to have them here on the podcast. Adam, thanks for being the first guest on my new SITV show. I don't have the party favors or anything here, but
I'm honored.
Have to start with some of the unpleasantness that's gone on in the between fan interactions. You've always valued the connectivity the players have with the fans. In recent weeks, Russell Westbrook, DeMarcus Cousins, some interactions with fans. What's been your reaction to that, and is there any steps the league will take going forward?
My reaction is you never want to see things like that happen. I will say I'm just as sensitive about the fans and our customers in the arenas, of course, as I am about the players. And you've written about this before. We just need to find that right line, because I don't want to also suggest to the fans that once you come into the arena, you got to put tape over your mouth. I mean, I think, and even the players and coaches recognize that there's something. Heckling seems like an old-fashioned term, and I'm not sure what all the connotations are around it. So I want to make clear, when I say heckling, I mean the stuff that is appropriate. Mm-hmm. That you pay your money, you come, and you get to cheer for your team. You get to boo the referees, mm-hmm, or the opposing team or whatever else you want to do. But it doesn't cross a line. And that line, you know, of course, hate speech, it goes without saying. But I think even call it abusive language, mm-hmm, I think it is more accurate. And that we always have to focus on where that line is. And truth be told, that line has changed. And I think in terms of what's acceptable, certainly I've been in the league since the early 90s. I mean, what I think some people aren't aware of, what used to be yelled and screamed at players, at coaches back then, would never pass muster today. Mm-hmm. And I think also there's a realization that there are 18,000 high-definition cameras now, mm-hmm, in the arena, and that's everybody holding up their cell phone. And I think that's a good check on fan behavior, because people realize they're not going to get away with anything. So again, I think we're always looking to appropriately calibrate. There are things that we've done because of those recent incidents. We have a code of conduct. I mean, people are aware in arenas for those seats in the lower bowl, there are cards on their seats, and so it's a reminder of the code of conduct. We have a strict one warning policy. I mean, you can be thrown out for the first time doing something, but generally, if fans are out of line, they get a warning, and next time they're out. And what we've done is we've added additional personnel to our arenas. We put more notices on seats, so everyone knows just where that line is. So we want to create an environment that's great for the players and coaches and for the other fans as well.
We're coming off the NCAA tournament, and years from now it could look decidedly different if some of the rule changes you've talked about go into place. You know, back in February, you submitted a proposal to the union about dropping the age minimum from 19 to 18. Have you had any feedback from the union, and where do we stand with that?
I actually think you said back in February, it was back in September.
September, sorry.
We made a proposal. And I think with most things with the Players Association, I think it's critically important we negotiate behind closed doors, and so it doesn't become sort of a back and forth in the media. I would just say we continue to talk to them about it. I think we both have different issues that we're focused on. I think there's a general agreement, I will say, that 18 is probably better than 19 at this point. And I say probably only because I was also part of the negotiating team that advocated moving from 18 to 19. And even as recently as 5 years ago, when I first became commissioner, I thought we'd be better off at 20. But again, the world has changed a lot, even in the last 5 years, and the Condoleezza Rice Commission came in. There's been the additional very public criminal proceedings brought against people who've been involved in college sports. There's the most recent issues around the shoe companies. So I am of the personal view on that on balance, we would be better off going from 19 to 18 at this point. That's not clearly held view by many of our teams. I can understand it. If I were a general manager or president of basketball and my job were to draft players, I'd want them to be 25. I mean, the more that you see them play under top-notch competition and conditions, presumably the better the draft is going to be, and it makes the draft a little riskier even when we get younger. But I think that our ability, if we go to 18 and we can work issues out with the NCAA where they adjust their eligibility rules so it's clear that at a younger age, in terms of the top cohort, who are pretty clearly identified, as you know, that we can get more engaged with them in terms of helping them develop their game, help them develop themselves personally, physical health, mental health, dealing with stress, etc., that we'll be in a better position when they come into the league. So it's we're going to continue discussing this issue with the Players Association, and I'm hoping that we'll make some progress.
Was there any one issue that turned your opinion on this? Because your predecessor, David Stern, he got the rule changed in 2005, you know, has been fighting for it to be, or fought for it to be above 20, was advocating for it as recently as 2012. Was there any one specific thing that happened that turned your opinion?
I'm not sure if it was one specific thing other than what a big business college sports have become. I mean, it always was to a certain extent, but I think now that the television money is so big, the social media presence is so large among these players, the incentives for the college programs are so great to win, that it's a bit of a broken market, I would say. I think when we have economists, whether they look at our system or look at the college system, I think it's fairly predictable, unfortunately, that if you try to control a market in that way, in essence, and say that players cannot be paid, and yet the value of those players, those top players to the school, is so great, you create incentives for pushing compensation underground and inappropriate behavior. Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing precisely what an economist, a social scientist, would predict based on those misaligned incentives. And so I just think those issues have always been around, but as they become magnified that much more, I think that was the turning point for me. And I'd say I'm also sensitive to the risk that the players are taking. I mean, it wasn't, as you know, I'm a Duke grad, mm-hmm. and yes, you know, when Zion slipped, you know, and his sneaker blew up, you know, I thought, oh my God, just like everyone else. And I do think for these young men, when their value is that great, to restrict them in the way we have at this moment isn't necessarily in the best interest. Now, I think working with the college community, you can deal with a lot of those issues through insurance, you know, again, through dealing with eligibility and access at a younger age. As Coach K recently said, I think the solution can't be created in isolation either by the college community or by the NBA. I mean, we are in a slightly different position than the NCAA, because anything we do has to be collectively bargained with our Players Association. But so if you bring those three parties to the table, we all have to operate in unison in terms of what's ultimately best for the players and the game.
I heard from a lot of people inside teams that appreciated your candor at the Sloan Conference about how talking about the issues the league still needs to tackle to grow. Two of those issues I wanted to ask you about. Tampering. The Lakers have been involved in a couple of investigations over the last few years involving tampering. There seems to be a level of sophistication to tampering that's evolved over the last few years. How do you view tampering? Do you see it as a significant problem that the league is dealing with?
That's a good question. I'd say your question seems to be premised on this notion that it's gotten significantly worse. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about that. I mean, when
a lot of teams do believe that it's gotten worse.
I accept that, and you talk about you know, level of sophistication. I think some things that are viewed as tampering, and maybe the league has to find a way to address it, but is not historically viewed as tampering by us. They've just been amplified by social media. For example, players talking about their desire to be on their teams has not historically been tampering. Players talking to other players about their desire to play together has historically not been viewed as tampering, because players can't make trades, for example. Players aren't in charge of signing other players. If we were to find out as a league that a player was acting as the agent for a team, that would be very different, meaning player X was told by his team, all right, go out and talk to this guy and tell him the following things. That's clearly tampering. But players generally talking about their desire to be in certain markets hasn't been. Now, again, you know, everything's always on the table. I mean, it has to be negotiated with the Players Association. But when I step back, the issue is, you know, ultimately, the job of the league is to create the best possible competition. And so then the question is the conduct of certain teams giving them an unfair advantage? Mm-hmm. And I have no reason to believe that is worse than it was historically. And in fact, I think because of social media, because of the enormous amount of media scrutiny on this league and the enormous amount of transparency, I actually think there's more information available to players and their representatives than there was, for example, 10 years ago, that there aren't that many secrets in the league, and therefore, and I think more information is good, and that's one of the ways to combat any sort of corruption in the system, is to make sure people have perfect information. So a team is not in a position where they're the only ones who talk to a player and they're the only ones who know what's going on. Now, some people who are watching this may be thinking, how naive of him to be saying these things. So I will say, at the end of the day, we're not the FBI. You know, there's limits to our ability to investigate. And part of the underlying theory of how a league operates is a sense of partnership and trust. And now, maybe things are breaking down in all areas of society to a certain extent, where teams aren't operating in the same good faith manner as they have historically. So we got to look at those things, and you know, ultimately we have to. It's on the league, you know, to, well, we may not. We have certain resources in which we can investigate. Obviously, you pointed to some cases where we've taken action. But I also say, if you went back, and we do this as a league, if you went back over the last 5 years, the number of times where the media or others or even teams have told us, you're being naive at the league office, they have a deal. And where the response from the league office has been, hey, if you've got proof, bring it to us. But just to say, you know, and we don't, mm-hmm. how are we supposed to respond to that? And I was about to say, if you go back and look at the number of those instances, and most of them, you could also look at the public accounting of them, very few of them actually turn out to be true. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm a little reluctant to just buy into this premise that things are much worse, because when you, at the end of the day, despite all those rumors, even the ones that went on this year about, yes, absolutely, deals in place, then trade deadlines come and go, and lo and behold, those deals don't happen, and then those people are left to say, well, you know, yeah, but, you know, and this is a different reason that it got screwed up, but I am saying, yeah, but you told me this deal was absolutely done, and it was in place, so... A long-winded answer saying it's something we got to continue to monitor.
The last thing I want to ask you about is, you did bring up the issues of economic disparity between big and small market teams. You addressed this at the Sloan Conference, where teams, paraphrasing here, might have to choose between putting out a winner and having a team that is profitable. You called it a fault in the system. How do you address that fault?
First of all, let me just be clear. What I think I said at the Sloan Conference was that it's not a function of big and small markets. Mm-hmm. It's a function of large payroll teams and smaller payroll teams, meaning those teams that choose to go well into the tax versus those teams that don't. And if you look at those actual teams, it does not correlate all that closely to market size. Mm-hmm. And it may be either because an individual owner has the means to do it, or maybe doesn't quite have the means to do it, but feels driven to do it in order to compete. And I'd say, from a system standpoint, what I don't like about it, for example, now I believe we have 5 taxpayers out of 30 teams, is that it's not a perfect correlation, but the more you spend does correlate to a better team on the floor. And what you don't want to have is a system where some teams, again, because ownership has the means or they just feel compelled to because of pressures in their community, are spending well beyond the salary that the market or they can support in order to compete. And a large group of teams, in this case 25 teams in the league, have decided that that tax line is one they won't cross. And I think ideally you'd want a system where you have roughly the same number of chips, in essence, for every organization, and then they're competing based on management or, you know, desirability of playing in that market, or culture created, mm-hmm. all of those things, but not based on who's willing to spend the most money. And these are not new issues that the league has been dealing with, but I'm also very sensitive to ownership, who's then put in a position by a question, whether it's from a media or from a fan, to say, are you willing, you know, to go well into the tax? Because that's going to be the measure of how much you care about this team. And I think that's an unfair position mm-hmm. to put a team in. But, and even take unfairness out of the equation completely, the real issue ultimately is, how do we create the best product? And I think that's, and that's probably the way to look at it, more from a standpoint of the fan. And fans, you know, in 30 markets, and then fans globally who hopefully are picking teams throughout North America who they choose to support. And I could say, if I were a fan of a team, I don't think it's a function of the market size, but you'd say, well, I'm a fan of a team that has one arm tied behind its back mm-hmm. because they don't have the resources to spend like this other team has. So, and the last thing I'll say on this is, you know, again, not new issues, but the competitive landscape is changing dramatically every day. The advent of 5G, the advent of additional bandwidth, meaning unlimited choices for consumers in terms of entertainment options, unlimited opportunities for streaming media on their phone, on their computers, on their television sets, that we then have to spend that much more time ensuring that our game is competitive all the time. And so the issue for us ultimately and the players as we sit down and discuss it, to me, again, I can understand from a player's standpoint, their number one issue isn't going to be about fairness to an owner or not. It should be, as our business partners, how do we create the best possible competition on the floor to ensure that we're able to compete against all these other options? And we better focus on that, or else, you know, we risk losing fans because everything is changing so quickly.
Is the difference, just to follow up quickly, is the difference in the local TV contracts a significant issue for you? Your counterpart with MLB, Rob Manfred, he said recently that there's tremendous revenue disparity in our game, and I think that if we had more of a national model close to what the NFL has, it would solve a lot of the competitive issues for them, kind of level the playing field.
I'm not sure, and to say baseball is a very different game. Mm-hmm. I think in the case of the NBA, if we look back historically, a team's willingness to spend into the tax has not correlated all that closely with the size of its local media deal. There are disparities in our local media deals, but that's addressed through revenue sharing. Mm-hmm. I think in a perfect world, I'd love the NFL system where teams are more reliant on national and international media, and so that is a leavening mechanism of sorts. But they at the same time also have a very different salary mm-hmm. system, and I think it would help if there was more equal distribution of revenue around the league, but it wouldn't solve the problem, again, because the pressure on those teams is so great and the desirability to win is so great that they end up making diseconomic decisions. And ideally you want a system where, because I think it's in both the league, the teams and the players' interest, you want a system where teams are both encouraged to invest in their franchises, and that means you need a model that's where you can generate a profit. I'm a strong believer in capitalism, and that when teams are able to be profitable, they reinvest in the practice facilities, they build new arenas, they do a better job marketing the team globally. And the other side of the coin, you need a system where everybody has the opportunity, not the guarantee, By the way, that's the same with profitability. Not the guarantee. You still have to do a great job managing your franchise, but you also need a system where you have the opportunity to compete on a level playing field for a championship. We've made a lot of progress over the years, but I still think we can create a better system over time.
Adam, appreciate your time. The opportunity to compete, you're headed kind of towards that. I mean, if things break right in free agency, you could have 7-8 teams next year, potentially looking like a champion.
I would just say, in response to all your questions, I'm sort of looking at the glass half full. Mm-hmm. But I think over my, getting close to now 3 decades with the league, I think it's amazing how much progress mm-hmm. we've made. And I look at the league now. Remember, this is a league where 3 teams have won roughly 60% of all championships. Mm-hmm. And we've now had 7 different teams who've won championships over the last 11 years. So based on any historical perspective, we've only gotten better over mm-hmm. time. That doesn't mean that for fans of a particular team who bump into me and say, can't you do a better job? I agree we can, but I think that's we working together with the Players Association to always be stepping back and thinking, all right, we have this competition among our teams, there's conflict between league and players, but we can't lose sight of the fan, and stepping back and saying collectively, how do we create the best system to create the best competition in a really intense marketplace mm-hmm. that is dramatically changing every day.
Adam, appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks so much, Chris.
Percent of the work week is spent communicating, so it's important your team does it well. Enter Grammarly. Grammarly's AI helps teams communicate clearly the first time. It shows you how to make words resonate with your audience, helps with brainstorming, and lets you instantly create and revise drafts in just one click. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who use Grammarly to move work forward. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise ready AI.
The Humana Honor Medicare Advantage Plan gives you $1,860 back each year in your Social Security check. Choose coverage that helps you keep more money in your pocket. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. The Part B Give Back benefit pays part or all of your Part B premium, and the amount may change based on the amount you pay for Part B. Limitations and restrictions may apply. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.